42. I'm Howard Lula, and I'll be your moderator for this session. Before we get underway with the first presentation of this session, for those of you who have cell phones, I ask that you please put them on vibrate as a courtesy to our presenters. Once again, if you have a cell phone, please put it on vibrate as a courtesy to our presenter. Now to our first presentation of this session, which looks back at the Minnesota Twins when they had their early glory years from 1965 when they won the American League pennant and lost in 7 games to the Dodgers, to their near miss in 67 in the pennant race with the Red Sox and the Tigers, and their 2 Western Division titles in 69-70. He titles his presentation, Dynastic Aspirations, the Minnesota Twins, 1965-70, and he is the author of the forthcoming book, The American League in Transition, 1965-1975. He is attending his first convention and his first presentation from Allington, Connecticut. Here's Paul Tensler.
The germ of the idea for this book
came from...
Thank you for pointing that out. The germ of the idea for the book came to me in 2007. I've been looking at the dynastic years of the Yankees from 1947 to 1964, and then also looking at the dynasty that they had from 1976 forward, when the Steinbrenner money kicked in and the Yankees started preparing for the World Series again. I want to look at that block of time from 1965 to 1975, and I thought, gee, I wonder, what was the real, influence on teams at that particular time? And I narrowed it down to 3, looking backwards chronologically in the Oakland Athletics, of course, from 1972 to 1974, with 3 consecutive World Series. Before that, the powerful Baltimore Orioles teams from 69 to 71 held sway over the American League and won one World Series title. But before that, it was a little bit nebulous, but I settled on the Twins because, as you'll see in my presentation, they had some really quality players, and they did achieve a modicum of success, and thus, not quite following the footsteps of dynasty, I thus titled my presentation, Dynastic Aspirations, and I'll go into some detail for you. I also realized that stepping back in history, that we get everybody in this room, or any baseball fan, any degree, is a historian to some point. I also realized that most of the population of this country was born after 1975, after the somewhat arbitrary cutoff point in my book. So for Twins fans and baseball fans in general that want to look at that particular period from the late 60s to the mid-70s, I think this would be a good primer to maybe encourage further study in the topics. To begin with, the birth of the Twins, the old woeful Washington Senators of the 1950s who have been still performing for quite some time, this particular bad trait of a poor baseball team conflates with Western movement and various franchise shifts. Of course, the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn, the Giants vacating the polo grounds for San Francisco, the Philadelphia Athletics moving to Kansas City, just shifting the franchises during the mid-1950s. And Calvin Griffin gets caught up in this a little bit too. Long story short, he does decide in 1960, he's going to transfer the franchise from Washington, D.C. to Minneapolis. He brings along with him quite a few players that are going to blossom in the mid-1960s and become the real cornerstones of the great teams of the era that we're talking about here. One of his prime movers, through his own diligence, was Scout Joe Cambria. He worked the island of Cuba very diligently and found a very good number of prospects, such as Zoilo Rosales, Camilo Pascual, and some other supporting members. This can't be overlooked because now we're in the post-Jackie Robinson era, and more minority players are coming into the fold. This is a very important, especially the part of the Twins, and there's a little bit of a joke that goes from the Twins moved to the Twin Cities, they had that TC logo on their cap. The TC actually stood for 20 Cubans. I think that's simply hyperbole even for 10 Cubans, but nonetheless, just to make the point that they did have a lot of minorities, a large proportion of minorities on their roster. In writing my book, I just didn't want to pick up in 1965, so I stepped back a little bit to give some background on where the real tough Twins came from, where the real guts of the roster came from. In the interest of time, I'm just listing the players here, but these were all the players who were either signed directly by the Twins or acquired by a trade. Again, these are the players that really became the cornerstone of the great teams in 1965. Of course, you need a good manager to handle all these players. Cookie Lavagero came along in early 1961. He'd been the manager of the Senators for a couple of years. Kelvin Griffith decides, though, that he needs a change because the team isn't performing that well, and Sam Neely now steps up to become the manager midway through the 1961 season. The Twins don't have that much of an impressive record. They finished 28-500. Then, under Neely's full control in 1962, there's a pretty good turnaround here. And now the Twins surprised even the Yankees and finished 5 games behind the Bronx Bombers in 1962. Unfortunately, the record remained somewhat static in 1963. The Yankees were even better, which caused a little bit of angst in the American League because all of a sudden now was McGann and Whitey Ford were aging and becoming less powerful than they had been in the prime of their career. All of a sudden now the Yankees have people like Joe Pepitone, Tom Tresh, Cal Valley and Jim Bowler, the new stars, and there's a fear that this Yankee dynasty is going to continue yet even further into the decade. The Twins have a slip up in 1964. They fall a little bit below 500. 14 losses are attributed to Shoddy playing the infield, and suddenly now after two promising years, Sam Neely's job is now in jeopardy. Moving to 1965, to place a little bit of context to my book, I do point out that the Twins finally integrated their spring training hotel in Orlando, Florida. Again, for the younger members of our audience, this is kind of important to realize that there's still a lot of racial angst in the United States at this time. What's a benefit to the Twins at this particular point, though, is that now the entire team is housed under one roof. And given the number of minorities that they had on the roster, I felt that this is really an important point to share with people. Because of their performance in 1964, the Twins aren't expected to perform any better than fifth place. It looks like they're just going to be another mediocre team. Among some of the changes, though, Gordon Malzberger was relieved of his duties and Johnny Sanker, the pitching coach. In an oral history that Johnny Flipstein, the relief pitcher, gave, he said that Johnny Sanker was an interesting coach because he said he put an idea in a pitcher's mind and kind of let him figure it out more so than just have everything dictated to him. And this is important to the various members of the pitching staff. However, the real kingpin here for the coaching staff was Billy Martin being named as the third base coach. He's an aggressive man. His reputation does kind of precede him a little bit. Again, the practice that got him from the Yankees roster in the 1950s, he becomes sort of a vagabond second baseman, plays for a number of teams, finally ending his career in 1961 with the Twins. In various coaches' capacities, he does emerge as the third base coach. We can't understate the influence that he had on Zoilo Versailles and working with the other infielders, but especially Zoilo Versailles. In the course of my research, I read an interesting comment saying that Martin could pull Versailles aside and really dress him down from doing things wrong. He had to learn how to know how to handle different players in different situations. For example, Versailles didn't mind being talked to like that, but not in public, not in the clubhouse in front of the other players. So Martin's learning these different things. A lot of injuries were an unfortunate circumstance for the Twins throughout the entire year. And it really forced Sam Neely to juggle his lineup very, very often. Whether pitchers were hurt, whether regulars were hurt, whether Will Gaddy the catcher was hurt, there was all kinds of adjustments that had to be made in the lineup. I believe at one point he had something like 8 different lineups in 10 consecutive games. That's how often things had changed. However, the side benefit from this is that you have a number of players who were able to contribute. Somebody makes a great catch. There's an emergency fill-in starter for a particular game. Someone makes a great catch in the field, and there's this camaraderie that developed among the team, and they nicknamed it being the hero of the day. You know, somebody different always seemed to be coming up and making a very important play. And finally, this is all working for the Twins, injuries notwithstanding. And by the All-Star game, the Twins are 5 games in front of first place, and they're performing so well that they have 6 members of the team that actually get named to the All-Star game that played at the Gold Metropolitan Stadium, just down the rail line here. End of July, Sam Neely ends up in the practice with an umpire and is suspended for a couple of games. And Cal Narragon is named to be the interim manager. Important point to note here is that it was rumored that Neely wanted Billy Martin to become the manager. Calvin Griffith put the squash on that. The feeling was that perhaps Billy Martin would have been a little bit too anxious to become the manager, and Griffith thought that this was not the time to be able to do so. The team still perseveres, but then all of a sudden real disaster strikes. Harmon Killebrew was injured in a collision at first base. He dislocates his elbow. Stockton is going to be out for maybe a week or 10 days. It's discovered that the injury is far more significant than that. He basically misses almost all the rest of the regular season. However, bring up a little bit more historical context to this. About 2 weeks after that, the horrific Watts riots occurred in Los Angeles. The Twins were on the road at the time, and they ended up becoming the first team to play in Los Angeles right after the riots. What's interesting here is that flying into Los Angeles, the team was looking over, the square miles of the city were burned out because of the riots. Really, really bad situation. I had a chance to interview second baseman Jerry Kendall for my book, and I thought this would be something interesting to ask him, knowing the number of minorities that were on the team, and seeing this and obviously following the events in the newspaper, what was going on through the players' minds. He said, actually seeing the destruction, he felt brought the team closer together. That's how close the camaraderie they had. That apparently was a lot of color blanks on the team. And it just made the players feel much more closer together. It was a bonding spirit there, in spite of the horrific riots. The Twins opened up a 10-game lead. They pushed the pennant September 26th. Calvin Griffith is not among the celebrants. He stays in Minnesota. And he attempted to sell the team. The minority partner wanted to purchase some extra shares of the team. Griffith said no. The minority partner filed suit against him, and Griffith risked being served with papers if he came to Washington. So he decided to opt out and not attend the pennant clinching game. Of course, after clinching the pennant, the Twins faced the Dodgers in the World Series. The Dodgers took the game in 7 games. But the epitome of the team spirit that was evinced throughout the entire season, again, through injuries and other complications that took place during the season. They overcame all that, and there were several friendships that were also forged as a result of this. There was a 30th reunion in 1995 that a lot of the players came back to, and there were many comments made that it was amazing that how long some of these friendships lasted, that the germination of which occurred in 1965. And a little bit of icing on the cake. Versailles, through working with Billy Martin, is named the most valuable player, and Sam Neely is honored as the American League Manager of the Year. Then we come to the period 1966 to 1968. Now we have a real roller coaster of a period in Twins history. The Twins do have a swoon in 1966. They dropped to second place. It's a decent record, but not good enough to overtake the very powerful Orioles. So Calvin Griffith decides to make a couple changes. So Jimmy Hall, Don Mincher, and Pete Cimino were traded to the Angels for former Cy Young winner Dean Chance. This is to bolster the starting rotation and also make a little bit of room in the outfield as well, because Jimmy Hall was a center fielder. Don Mincher, of course, playing first base. Killebrew, I believe, completely over his injury. He's now pretty much stationed in the infield. He's not playing the infield as much anymore. We have a new second baseman. Second baseman position for quite some time in the Twins' history had kind of revolving door with a whole bunch of different players. But Rod Carew comes along. He's installed as the new second baseman. Like to say, the rest is history. But the 67 season is not progressing that well. In early June, Cal Ripken Fire Chief Sam Neely, Cal Irwin was recalled from the AAA team in Denver. Irwin writes the team, and probably the best way to describe this, and those old enough to look through this and seen it the first time around, the only way to describe 1967, the last month, really was the wildest season, probably in our lifetime. We had four teams fighting for the pennant going into the last week of the season. It was really quite a joy to watch that. I was a school kid at the time, and it was great to have a little transistor radio to keep track of the games as things were going on. The Twins were ahead by one game going into the final two-game series in Boston, but they ended up losing. They lost both games by two runs, so the pennant was theirs to lose, and unfortunately, that's exactly what happens. And they finished in second place again at 91-71. Silver lining, though, Carew does win the American League Rookie of the Year award, but changes again are in the offing. Rosales, Grant, Budkett, Grant were traded to the Dodgers for protection help. John Roseborough to spell an often tired and very banged up role batting. Robert Lane Miller to commit as a pitcher, and Ron Paranoski to bolster the relief staff. Paranoski actually ended up leading the league in American League in saves for two of those years, so he was a very good acquisition. Unfortunately, in 1968, the year of the pitcher, the Twins fall to seventh place, and there's again instability in the manager's chair. Cal River was let go. But again, riding the roller coaster, the continuation, the Twins do have a rebound in 1969 in the face of some rather major changes to the game. Of course, there are rule changes, the pitching mound is lowered, the strike zone is altered somewhat, there's expansion in both leagues. The National and American League both split into two divisions. The Twins become part of the New American West, and a major change that affects all of baseball. Louis Kuhn was named commissioner in February. And another new face, the manager's chair for the Twins, Billy Martin, finally arrives as a major league manager. You know, Cardenas is also acquired to bolster up the infield. He's traded for once promising pitcher Jim Merrick. And the Twins do very well in the market. Their aggressive style of play is good, but unfortunately there's some overtones, the negative overtones with regard to the Twins. Martin leads them to a 97-65 record, but he does build on his unsavory parts of his reputation. In late July, former Vice President Hubert Humphrey comes to visit the clubhouse. This is unfortunately after the Twins' loss. Billy Martin sees a lot of yuck and yuck going out in the clubhouse and excuses the former vice president because the players are supposed to be disappointed downcast after a loss. When Calvin Griffin gets word of this, he's absolutely outraged that the local, well-known politicians say nothing of the former vice president was treated this way, even though Martin said he was tactful in the dismissal. It doesn't go over well with Griffin at all. A couple weeks later, the Twins are on the road in Detroit against the Tigers, and there's the famous brawl. Bobby Allison and Dave Boswell were having out. Martin gets involved. Boswell ends up with a few punches to the face. This does nothing to enhance Martin's reputation in his combat. The Twins, again, carried on and won the division title, but they faced one of the most powerful teams of the 1960s, the 1969 Baltimore Orioles, under their first year manager, Earl Weaver. The Twins are swept, although it's a little bit of a distortion there. The first two games went extra innings, so they're very close, but the third game was not, and it turns out that Billy Martin is dismissed as manager. So now we move to 1970. Harmon Killebrew did win the American League Most Valuable Player Award, a little bit of a silver lining there. For 1970, Bill Rigney is brought in as manager to stabilize the ship. Dean Chance, Bob Miller, some prospects, Greg Nettles, and Ted Hulander were sent to Cleveland for Stan Williams. And Louis Tion was brought in to bolster the pitching staff for the starting rotation and did a good job of it up until the time the injury bug caught up again. Who suffered torn knee ligaments in a play against the Milwaukee Brewers. Boswell and Tion were also hurt, but they managed to persevere because Luke came in by the name of Bert Blyleven. The story is like to say the rest is history. He performed very well in his rookie season and continued to be a bulwark of the starting rotation. Despite the injuries, the Twins repeated as West champs. The Twins were again swept by the Orioles and even told Tony Oliva, but he said, 1969, we didn't look too good because we lost three games, but the margin of victory for the Orioles this time around really put the stamp on the fact that the Orioles were a far superior team. Another silver lining, though, Jim Perry and controversial voting won the American League Young Award. Dynastic aspiration for the Twins. So what? It was a question I was always given in my history course. You know, you write a great narrative, you tell a great story, but my professors were asking that so what question. I would defer to Dave St. Peter, who gave a great presentation this morning, and I agree with his comment that this was really one of the best teams of the late 1960s. So to bolster the argument for that, we have to look at dynasty and put it in a little bit of a different perspective. At the time, we have the Green Bay Packers are great, the Boston Celtics are great, and the Yankees have just come off their dynasty. So dynasty in terms of really winning the whole enchilada, the world championship of this particular sport, that's what makes it a little bit different in the Twins instance. So dynasty, we have to bend the definition a little bit. The trajectory is not very low, but this is playing exactly to Dave St. Peter's point. The Twins' record from 65 to 1970 wasn't substantially worse than the powerful Baltimore Orioles of that same period. They're 19 games less spread over 5 years. That's only a couple of wins per season. It's different. Over the course of the time frame we're talking about, they did win one pennant. They almost won a second. They did capture the first two American League West titles. They featured three Hall of Famers. And they had a relatively nice group of what I call tier two standouts. Allison, Batty, Oliva, Jim Cott, McNeil, Castrell, and Rand Bunkowski. Looking over some figures, I would size Tony Oliva perhaps. Maybe the veterans community can look at Jim Cott, because 283 wins is a little bit short of 300 wins. He's not the magic figure, but I'll take the 16 gold gloves and a pitcher with a hit. I think that's certainly worthy of a few votes that maybe get him a platinum or another shot as well. So, in conclusion, dynastic aspirations. Aspirations is exactly what it means. It was not a dynasty achieved. They did aspire to dynasty. Looking back from a historical standpoint, we can see that they came close in some regard, but they didn't have quite the trajectory that the major teams did, but they did the best they could, and they were one of the premier teams in the late 1960s. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for Paul?
In your tier two standouts there, would you include Jim Perry?
Yes, I would. He really righted himself. He was acquired by the Twins in 1963, and I believe it was 1968 or maybe even 1969. He was so mediocre that he was on the verge of being released. He was almost released, almost a forgotten man in spring training in one of those intervening years. But in 1969, 1970, he did perform admirably. There was a controversial vote for this morning to Cy Young, but he was a 20-game winner, and obviously, controversy notwithstanding, he did come out ahead with the points to win the Cy Young Award. Yes, the gentleman in the middle.
What happened to Flaherty after 65?
He was traded to the Dodgers. I'm not sure if he made a claim with another team. I was very disheartened to read this morning, which I think was somewhere in the mid-1980s. He was working a menial job at the airport here in Minneapolis. I think he had ended up putting his, literally, the award for his MVP in hoc to get money. And I think he had given money to his family or whatever, so I think he died almost penniless, which is really too bad. Really too bad for a great player. Yes, the gentleman in the white t-shirt.
I've always wondered why Sam Neely never got another chance to manage in the majors?
That I don't know. Perhaps he was not part of the good old boy network at that point. I might broach a guess that of Italian descent, that there may have been some prejudice against Italians. Only a guess on my part. I have no idea. But no, you're correct. He did not manage in the major leagues. Yes, in the Cincinnati.
You're talking about how close they were in 1965 players, but I think I read something like 1967 there was a lot of divisions.
Yes, that's correct.
Thoughts on that?
Yes, there was some division in the clubhouse because The players had taken a vote as far as who's going to get World Series shares. Now, Neely had been dismissed partway through the season, and there was one group in favor of giving Neely a cut if they had won the pennant, and another group in favor of not giving him a cut. There were only two players who said goodbye to Neely when he was fired. I think Carmen Killebrew was one. I forget who the other one was. But there was this division between the players as to whether he would even get a World Series share. The people who were disappointed in his performance and keeping the team on track, I think they ended up holding sway. But there was a comment from a player on another team that said, "I can't believe this is going on in your clubhouse that you cut a guy out, cut a manager out of a World Series share that participated in to a limited degree, I guess, except the success of the team." Yes, in the back.
Paul, a couple of things. Appreciate what you've done here. I wonder if you could comment further that a couple of things. Johnny Sain's role as a pitching coach, because I think he had a good reputation. Perhaps relevant to your comments about Cott had his big season the year after their 65 pennant. Maybe had he been a 20-game winner at 65, he might be more well-known today. Second of all, I think this was mentioned this morning. I think when you look at what Oliva accomplished in spite of injuries and in the pitcher's era, I'd like to see Oliva get a lot more ball consideration. You mentioned that before.
Yeah. With Oliva, I kind of fall back on a comment that I heard many, many years ago that for better or worse, the Hall of Fame is for the very best, not the very good. Again, proposed by the Veterans Committee with different players and those who were favored by former players on the committee who may have been friends that have some sort of influence in voting with that, I think holds sway. With regard to Cott, I think you're right. I think if he'd beaten Sandy Koufax in the seventh game, the 65, I think there probably would have been a better chance that he would have ended up perhaps in the Hall of Fame or drawn more consideration.
So do you have an opinion as to which was the best team ever?
Among all these twins?
Yeah.
I would probably favor the 65, because Will Batty was still catching. Somehow, with the research that I did, found the pain and agony that he went through, and being a Gold Glove winner and decent hitting catcher, he was a very integral part of that team, so I would probably favor him. Yes?
When you say Minnesota was the first AL team to play in LA after the riots, you mean those are the games?
Yes. Yeah, the first visiting team, that's correct.
Got 4 minutes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
How did Dean Chance do with the Twins?
Chance did pretty well, but he ended up being traded to Cleveland, I believe, after 1970. He never reached the potential after winning the Cy Young Award in 1964. I mean, that was like his breakthrough year, so to speak, but he pitched well on occasion after that, but never reached that Cy Young potential thereafter. Yes, the gentleman with the great cap. Aspirations and went to the Baltimore Orioles camp. It's an interesting question. In the course of doing my research, Harry Dalton, the general manager of the Orioles, was sent a note from the program manager of WINS radio station in New York City in 1966, a very brief note, said, "Congratulations, Harry, keep the dynasty coming," which is a little bit premature at that point. But by 1969, with Frank and Brooks Robinson, a lot of these veterans really hitting their stride. I think that really just put them over the top as far as being the most powerful team. I would think the argument just based on the victories that they accumulated. I think from 69 to 71, they ran up a win total of like 321 wins, 109 wins, 108, 104, I think, were the three victory totals that year. So just by pure seasonal performance alone, I think that puts them at the head of the class of any of the period from the mid-1960s to the 1970s.
Single take, one more question.
Okay. Okay, one more question, but my invitation is open. You know, hit me off the hall or any other time that you want to, and we'll be happy to answer your question. Yes, the gentleman in the back?
Billy Martin has become notorious in recent years for kind of overusing the starters in his managerial career. Can you talk about the workflows of the Georgia starters and the player out their hands and what happened to them?
Question about the workload of the starting pitchers in the Twins. I have my packet, all the statistics. I had a feeling I might get a question just like this. Off the top of my head, I don't know how many innings pitched for any given one, but obviously, Perry and Cotton were the two big guns that the Twins had in 1969, and I think Perry Dempsey.
I said it was the last question. I want to know. We're out of time.
Okay, thank you.